Ms. Tate, good morning to you. You may approach.
Good morning. I'm Cindy Tate. I'm an assistant Douglas County Public Defender, and I'm here representing Jacquez Clifton. There were three key issues with regards to Mr. Clifton's trial that we felt were important to bring before this Court of Appeals, or the Supreme Court. First one being the motion to suppress, which was a conditional. We had part of our motion that was granted and part of it which was denied. With respect to the motion to suppress, we feel that the trial court erred in not finding that the moment that Mr. Clifton said, "I can't," those very words, not once, but twice, that the court erred in not granting our motion to suppress his statement under the argument that it was an unequivocal indication of his right to remain silent.
Well, I can't what?
I'm sorry, Your Honor.
I can't what?
I can't.
Can't tell you the names of the other people?
I can't talk. I can't.
No, I didn't say that.
Proceed. He did not say that.
No. He said, "I can't. I don't want to tell the names because I don't want other people telling me, ratting on me." So that was his reason for saying, "I can't," wasn't it?
It was, I can't talk. And he made that clear to Detective Davis, which Detective Davis ignored throughout the entirety of the interview.
What happened right after he said that? In other words, if you take those statements in context, what happened next?
With regards to that, Detective Davis continued to talk to him, continued to try to draw out of him, and to continue to try to get him to talk more. If you notice throughout the interview with Detective Davis, that even after the point where the trial court did find that he had invoked his right to remain silent, Detective Davis just kept going. He just completely bowled over, ignored everything that Jacquez had said about, I'm ready to go. I have nothing more to say. I'm ready to go.
Where?
Well, exactly. My case in point is,
now,
I
think
can't.
The question is, how is that unequivocal? It sounds very equivocal to me. Persuade me otherwise.
I believe it's just as unequivocal as this court has found in DeJong when the defendant in that case said, "Done." Done with what? How about when she stated, "I want to go to sleep." That doesn't mean she's done talking. Also when she says, "I'm tired." Tired of what? The questioning? Or just tired and I want to go to sleep? This court held that those were unequivocal statements of her invocation to cease the conversation with the officer. In that case, the officer continued as well, too.
Hasn't this court consistently resisted reading words in isolation and instead emphasized the importance of reading, construing statements in the context of the overall discussion, because that really informs what's being understood by the officer and communicated by the defendant?
It could be, exactly. I think the court has done that. I think that in an opportunity to view the not just the words that are being stated, but the actions and demeanor that is taking place during an interview.
And here, didn't his words suggest frustration with the questioning?
Mr. Clifton's? No, I do not believe so. I believe that Mr. Clifton did not want to talk. I believe that he did not want to say anything. That Detective Davis used such phrases as a cold-blooded killer. He was evoking Mr. Clifton's, I guess for a lack of a better term, his instinct to respond, to defend himself with regards to, "No, I'm not a cold-blooded killer. I didn't do this." You know, he asked to see his son. He wanted to go. He wanted to see his son. Detective Davis played upon that. Detective Davis also played upon the fact that my client's mother had passed away very recent to his interrogation, and used those to get a 19-year-old to talk more than when he said, than he wanted to, when he said, "I can't. Can't."
I think Judge Castle had a question when I interrupted.
It's all right. Go ahead.
Mr. Clifton's statements, we feel, Your Honors, should have been stricken from the moment that he said, "I can't."
What did the judge allow in after that?
After that, he allowed up to the point where there was discussion about his part in going to the residence, being at the door and holding the door open, in that he thought that there was a robbery that was going to take place. So those statements were very critical for the reason that, and it's not harmless error to allow them, if the court finds that it was, should have been suppressed, those statements were still not harmless error because of the fact that credibility was such an issue in this case. Co-defendant Absalom Scott was on the stand for the better part of a day, and everything that he said was impeached top to bottom. And the fact that he was the only one out of the three gentlemen who entered that house that evening that said that our client had said it was a robbery, it was going to be a robbery, therefore, the statements that Jacquez made in saying, hey, it would have been a robbery, were very important to that because if you recall, Rico Larry, another co-defendant, testified there was never any plan to rob. And it was the defense's contention that it wasn't until this went down and something bad went happened that Absalom Scott, one who went into the residence of Skeet, got the gun, brought it into the car, and then turned around and took it back to Skeet's after the alleged homicide, that this whole story of a robbery gone bad was a lie perpetrated by Absalom Scott. So
you just said the alleged homicide?
Well, the homicide, I apologize.
Okay.
I'm still in trial mode sometimes. You still go that route. The second issue that came up that we felt was very important was the Batson issue that we raised during jury selection. There were a total of four non-black jurors who were in our pool, who were up to the point where we got to the point where we were striking. And we feel that the state struck three out of the four for
you
the year.
You said non-black. Are you meaning there were four black jurors?
There were four black jurors.
Okay, not non-black. But
correct.
Black.
My apologies. I misspoke. There were four black jurors, three of which were stricken by
what percentage would that equate to as far as the total number of African-American jurors that were left on the jury?
There was one that was left,
mm-hmm.
and then obviously the three were stricken. Your Honor, I apologize. I'm not a mathematician.
That'd be 25% of percentage. The African-American jurors were left on the jury.
Correct.
Okay.
But when you're talking about a gentleman who is entitled to a jury of his peers, and there's only 25% of that jury,
well,
that he's looking
be,
at...
Can you be arguing that he has to have an all-black jury?
No, I am not. No, I'm not.
Why didn't he have a jury of his peers?
For the fact that the state, we believe, struck three out of the four for race-based. They were not neutral causes for which they struck them. In taking a look at their responses and their answers to the questions that were posed during jury selection, they were no more detrimental to the state than any other jury that they allowed
but
to be on.
But if the prosecution had that mindset, why would they leave, or why would the prosecution leave any black jurors on the jury? Why out of three out of the four, there were reasons given for striking those jurors, which the court determined were not pretextual. I mean, once you get past your prima facie showing that there's a violation, and then the state offers its explanations, then the court weighs those to determine whether or not it's going to believe what the prosecution says or its reasons for striking those black jurors, and why would these reasons be pretextual? I mean, you're making a comparison to the remaining jurors as far as the same answers that were given, and you say because those same answers were similar that you can't strike the African-American jurors for whatever reason?
We're saying that the state's reasons for striking those jurors were race-based.
Counsel, you make sort of a comparative analysis argument under Foster v. Chapman on appeal, and I want to know whether that same argument, the same argument that you made in your briefing, was made to the district court judge during trial.
It was not, Your Honor. We had stated that we did not make it at that time. Foster v. Chapman, I don't believe, had been decided at that point. If I'm remembering my dates right, this case was tried during September of 2015, and this decision wasn't reached until May of 2016.
Obvious question then. How could the court have erred in analyzing the arguments that were never presented?
What I think is unique about Foster versus Chapman is that the court had to go back on post-conviction. On its face, the trial court and at the appeals level could not make that determination. It took a post-conviction action and dredging through documentation because on its face, clearly the Court of Appeals did not feel, in, at the appellate level at each stage, they did not feel that on its face, based upon the transcript, that there had been a discrimination that had been made. It took going back through documentation of the big sheets that we get, notes, for them to make that determination. In this case, our case is different because we believe that that discrimination was on its face. It's in the record. For example, we don't need to go back and look at their notes. The reasons for striking Juror Black was that she would probably have a problem with convicting the defendant, but she told them in their responses that she would have no problem convicting the defendant. Their argument that they were afraid because she worked in juvenile court that she would possibly know the penalties for first-degree murder is preposterous. You're going to strike out any potential juror. The first question that all potential jurors, when they walk in that door or fill out a jury form, is, do you happen to know what the penalties are for first-degree murder? Anyone living and residing in our state right now, even my 16-year-old daughter who's in high school, who can't vote, can't serve on a jury, knows what the penalties are for first-degree murder. Can't strike her just because she happens to know on her own through the media, through education process, what the penalties are for first-degree murder.
Well, are the penalties different for first-degree murder?
Depending on what, if it's a 1A or just a 1, there are different penalties for first-degree
murder. Does everyone know that?
I think, you know, you're asking a general question. I think that a lot of people believe that life, and especially with what media we have going on right now with our governor procuring the drugs to implement our death penalty, I think that in large portion, the state voted to reinstitute the death penalty. You can't tell me that the citizens of this state are not educated as to what the penalties are, whether or not they work in the system or they are a farmer from the western part
Is it your belief that the citizens know the degrees of culpability that may pertain to a crime committed by a number of persons, such as the distinction between accomplice or who pulled the trigger or felony murder and things of that nature?
That's where it becomes complicated. And during jury selection, we spend a lot of care and take a lot of time in trying to garner information about from them what that knowledge is. What is
so
really
you're saying, I beg your pardon, you're saying, this is number 8, right? It was a numbers jury? This is juror number 8?
Correct, Ms. Black.
Okay.
Yes.
And she knew too much.
Well, that's what the state alleged that she did, without garnering any...
Well, wasn't there reason for juror 8 was that she was a therapist, and she might think that, given the age of Clifton, that alternative penalty should be applied because he was of tender years, and wasn't that part of the reason given by the state, that the therapist might give him sympathy as a young offender since he worked with juvenile offenders?
That was what the state said. However, during the back and forth with Juror Black, she stated to the state in response to their question that if they could prove their case beyond a reasonable doubt, she would have no problems convicting the defendant of the crimes that were charged.
So does a trial judge or a prosecuting attorney have to take those statements at face value? Isn't the body language that's used part of the process?
It is part of the process. None of that was cited with regards to Juror Black.
Isn't that why we have trial judges that make these calls?
As far as when we make our Batson challenges?
When you make your Batson challenges,
yes.
The trial judge ultimately has to determine whether or not you've proved that it was pretextual.
Yes.
And
that is, and we believe that the trial judge in this case erred.
Why was Juror 13 stricken?
Juror 13, I believe, and I've got names. I apologize. I don't have numbers. There was Juror Owens, who was the female.
Juror 13 had a 25-year history of alcohol and drug
Correct.
Abuse.
Yes, that was Juror Owens.
Was that the reason given by the state?
The state felt that Juror Owens would somehow, she would be somehow sympathetic to
this. Was a drug deal that went bad.
That, absolutely.
Good.
If anything, I think that would make her sympathetic toward the victim, not to the perpetrators
the drug dealer?
Of the crime.
Would make her sympathetic towards the drug dealer that got shot?
Absolutely. Good. That it's he's dealing drugs, he's supplying the need, there was no reason for him to die. It could have gone both ways. It could have been that they were sympathetic. The biggest issue that we had with regards to this was the subsequent juror Wright, who during his interaction, he was never forthcoming. There were other jurors who were non-blacks that were not forthcoming either. The state acknowledges they then went based off of physical appearance. They stated that the two other jurors they decided to keep on were young. Our gentleman, who was black, was older. They felt he'd be more set in his ways. That he felt that the younger jurors could maybe be talked into going along.
That's race neutral, isn't it? I mean, the color has nothing to do with that.
Well, I guess the difficulty in this
I want somebody to go along with the rest of the people. This guy appears to be not forthcoming. He's older than the rest, and he may be the one that holds out. I don't want it. What's wrong with that?
Well, when you stand up before the potential jurors and you say, do you have the ability to have a mind of your own?
Well,
will you be able to hold steadfast to what you believe?
They're all going to say that. And the ones that don't want to stay on the panel say, no, I can't make up my mind, or I think he's guilty, you know, and then they're going to be challenged for cause and eliminated, but they'll all say, yeah, I can, if they want to stay on the panel, they'll all say I can act independently.
I guess the blessing in disguise that came from Foster was the fact that we had paper documentation of the discrimination that was happening. We can't open up a prosecutor's heart or mind. We have to base it off of what the record is. Foster versus Chapman, they were very fortunate. It was years and years and years before they discovered the discrimination that took place with regards to that selection. We don't have that process. I'm not sure a trial judge, while I'm trying to argue a Batson motion, is going to allow me to walk over and ask for the notes of the prosecutor. If I was a prosecutor, I'd say absolutely not.
Maybe that's old school. Prosecutors don't make notes.
But you don't have to necessarily believe the prosecutor's reason, do you? You just have to believe that the reason he offered was racially neutral. And
yes.
That that's sufficient to justify his selection of that juror, and that's a trial court's decision because the trial court's there observing the parties. We don't observe the parties, and we don't see their body language, you know. The juror may have been sitting like this, you know, and his body language maybe, but I don't see that's not a race-neutral explanation for why he picked juror number 14?
Mr. Wright, yes. Your Honor, I guess, again, the difficulty of this is we're trying to read into the minds, and we can't. We base it off of what was stated and what was done at that time. We made our objections based off of what type of questions were asked by the prosecutors, the responses that were elicited in comparison to the responses that were elicited from non-black jurors. And you initially asked a question, and I will end with this, about, well, they left one on. Why would they leave one if they were, my opinion, they left one, for lack of a better word, one token individual black juror on there. I don't know if it was to lessen the effect and say, hey, look, listen, we left one for him. That's a trial of its peers. The fact that the state also argued in their brief that because this was a...
Is the percentage of African-American individuals located in Nebraska of any significance as determining amount what would be a trial of someone's peers?
It It absolutely could.
Out of the total jury pool, that represented a population of, let's say there's population of African Americans in Nebraska is 12%.
What if this had been a situation where we had a majority of our pool that were African American? It could happen. I'm hoping it happens in my lifetime, but
sure.
It could happen.
And what? And then all of them were struck but one. That changes the percentages of the selection process, doesn't it?
But the law's not about percentages, Your Honor. The law is about a right to a fair and impartial jury of your peers. There's not, oh, you get 25%. Oh, you get only 50%.
No,
it's about a trial
Isn't that one of the factors you look at is that there were just four African Americans in this pool and there were only three that were struck, leaving 25% of the African Americans on the pool as part of the jury panel?
Law does not equate to percentages. It's fairness. My client was African American. They all could have been on there. They all could have been stricken. I still believe that we would have been here if they would have all been stricken. Thank you.
Thank you very much. Mr. List, good morning to you.
Your Honors, is the court, Nathan List, Assistant Attorney General, appearing on behalf of the athlete of the state of Nebraska. If time permits, I'll address each of the counsel's assignments of error. As far as the Batson claim, the state maintains that the prosecution provided legitimate reasons for its strikes, so the Batson challenge was properly denied. As far as the appellant's assertion that the prosecution's strikes were invalid under Foster v. Chapman, we disagree. As set forth in our brief, as well as our supplemental brief in State v. Lester, which is pending, Foster did not change.
There was no evidence that the prosecution had prior to Vore Dyer created a list in which he listed all the African Americans and then put a notation of strike on each one of those before he even questioned any of the panel, right?
No. This case in no way resembles.
Is it significant that there was one out of four left on the panel? Is that of any significance? Or are we beyond that when we're looking at the race-neutral reasons given by the prosecution?
I mean, I guess it could have some significance. The theory is that the state is just going to eliminate all black jurors for the sake of eliminating them and having a juror without black jurors. Then why would they leave? But, I mean, in terms of the analysis, we have to look at the reasons given for the juror's struck.
What does the judge do when it finally gets the ultimate decision as to whether or not the prosecution's reasons for the strike are race neutral? Does the judge have to find that it believes those reasons, or does it have to find that those reasons given are really not race based?
The what?
It doesn't have to believe exactly what the prosecution says is his reason. It just has to find that the reasons given are not race based.
Right.
You think under our jurisprudence that the number makes a difference? And the way I want to articulate this to you, isn't a prosecutor who exercises a race-based challenge against a single individual just as in violation of the Batson line of cases, even though that person has the race doesn't enter into their minds as to the others? Isn't it the taint of race in the individual juror that's important?
Yes.
And that would suggest that the numbers don't make a difference. What we're doing here is a proxy for looking into the heart and mind of the prosecutor and doing the best we can to do that. Right?
That's correct.
Okay. Yes.
As far as Foster, again, we submitted it. It didn't change the framework here. Foster simply went through the Batson analysis and concluded that under the third prong, the defense in that case had met their burden in proving purposeful discrimination, given that the prosecution had provided shifting explanations. The reasons given applied equally to non-black jurors that were permitted to sit on that jury, and the prosecution's file in that case that had been obtained was replete with evidence of racial discrimination against black jurors in that case. As far as the analysis about black jurors being struck for the same reasons as white jurors that were permitted to sit, the In that case, that analysis is not new. The court has applied that analysis on at least two prior occasions. So again, we'd submit Foster has not changed the game here. Applicable framework is still a three-pronged test set forth in Batson. And as far as strikes in this case, we would submit that those were legitimate strikes. We don't have the concerns that were present in Foster.
What was the number of the people in the panel that were proposed jurors in this case? How many were selected for the first round for the determination of who would be on the panel? How many people were there?
How many were initially brought into the box, or just how many jurors did we end up...
Now, how many jurors were examined for purposes of sitting on this panel?
I don't recall that number.
Well, there'd be a certain number that would be called, right? And then the prosecution and the defense would examine those jurors and then exercise a strike, and it goes down the line. One strikes first, then the other strikes. So what if you had a situation where you, where 80% of the jurors were African-American, and 80%, and the prosecution, in exercising its strikes, struck all African-Americans? Would that have some indication that there was some race factor in that, simply because the prosecution struck every single African-American it could strike in the jury?
Well, not necessarily. I mean, if they had specific insufficient individual race-neutral reasons for each individual, it wouldn't automatically amount to a Batson violation simply because they struck each and every black individual. And I think it goes back to Justice Castle's question about the fact that this is an individualized inquiry with respect to each particular juror. So that's what the analysis entails. I don't think we just look at one blanket number, just so we don't look at percentages. To say, well, that alone is going to be definitive, and we don't even look at...
Well, but could you consider that if, for example, you had six African-Americans on the panel and the prosecution struck them all with their challenges?
Well, yeah, absolutely. You could look at it. I mean,
that's a factor you can look at, isn't it?
Sure. The trial court's supposed to look at all the evidence and circumstances before.
Okay. So...
Would that include a purported tactic to leave one African-American on?
It could. I mean, I guess that comes down to the persuasiveness of the reasons that the prosecution's provided. If the court, in viewing that evidence, feels that, as defense counsel said, that they've left one token individual and they aren't buying the reasons that they've supplied for the other individuals, I mean, the trial court could take that into consideration.
Sure.
But in this case, we would submit their reasons were valid. That's a violation. That's a challenge is properly denied. I was going to move on to the suppression issue. If there are no further questions regarding the Batson issue. As far as the denial of the suppression motion, which pertained to the post-arrest interview of Clifton, we maintain it was properly, the defense motion was properly denied with respect to the statements he made prior to invoking his right to remain silent. All the statements made up to that point were properly admitted in our view. As far as the appellant's assertion that his entire interview should have been excluded because he wasn't immediately Mirandized, we disagree. Set forth in our brief, he was Mirandized within 5 minutes. Nothing that occurred prior to that was an interrogation. The detective simply obtained some biographical information from Clifton why he was there, that he'd been arrested in connection with the homicide. Clifton said he knew nothing about it, and they continued to have an unrelated discussion to the homicide. Then he was Mirandized before he discussed the homicide. This initial five-minute discussion was not an interrogation.
What's your understanding of the words, "I can't"? Have other courts considered that as far as whether or not that's an unambiguous exercise of your right to remain silent?
I'm not sure what other courts or jurisdictions have done with a response of that nature, Your Honor, but in the context of our record, we would submit that his response of "I can't," which was approximately 30 minutes into the interview, it was not a clear and unequivocal indication of his right to remain silent. The record reflects he'd already admitted.
Did he explain what he meant by "I can't"?
Yeah, he did.
What reason was given for that?
He'd already admitted that he was there during the murder. The detective was then pressing him for the details, asking who he was with. Clifton said, "I can't." And detective says, "Well, okay, I mean, you've already told me you're there, but don't you want to go the whole nine yards and give me all the details here and help me out and tell me everything?" And he said, "You know, I can't." He said, "Well, I I mean, you already told me you were there. Why can't you tell me that information? He said, because I don't want anybody telling me. Through that discussion, clarified, he just gave up the name. So, but it wasn't a clear, unequivocal indication that, hey, I'm done here. I'm done talking. I want this interview to end.
But he did, at some point in time, make some indication that he wanted the interview to end?
He did. He made statements to that effect, and the trial court excluded anything and everything that he said after that point.
What incriminating stuff did he say after that?
The only thing in particular that I recall is that he was asked whether or not Absalom Scott or Rico Larry were the individuals that he was with, and he confirmed that Rico was one of them. So I guess he just pointed to Rico and identified him as one of the individuals. But I think that's really the extent of additional incriminating information he provided beyond saying, admitting he was
and
there.
And the jury did not hear that?
No. That was redacted.
But the jury heard that he was there and that he didn't want the person to die. And what was the other incriminating statement he made during that interview?
I guess, in my mind, the extent of it really was just that he was there. Because, I mean, he admitted he was there, but said he basically had nothing to do with it. He was just used as a decoy. And the other individuals were the ones who committed the robbery and killed him. That really was the extent of his statement. And to the extent that he admitted he was there, I mean, that came in even before he said, I can't. This discussion about I can't prior to that. In any event, as set forth in our brief, we didn't submit any error. I think there was error, but any error with respect to the admission of this post-arrest interview was harmless, given that really the only thing it established was that he was there. That was undisputed in trial. Jacqueline Harrison testified at trial, specifically identified him as one of the individuals that was at the house during the murder. And the defense itself conceded that Clifton was there during the murder.
But that, because that factored into the theory of the defense.
Right.
Could you address the Brady claim?
Sure. As far as the denial of the motion for mistrial, which pertained to statements Clifton made to Absalom Scott and Rico Laird the day after the murder, the appellant claims the state failed to disclose this information prior to trial, which amounted to a Brady violation warranting a mistrial. The state's response, as set forth in our brief, is that even for the sake of argument, if this rose to the level of material information for purposes of Brady, I'm not sure that it does, but even if we assume that it does, that evidence was made aware to the defense during trial, and they were able to use that information to cross-examine and impeach the state's witnesses. So since it was disclosed during trial, it does not amount to a Brady violation. Thus, there was no basis to bring this trial based on there being
Brady. What are the elements of a Brady violation? The statement has to be either exculpatory or prejudicial? Is that the...
Generally, exculpatory or impeachment evidence.
Impeaching, yeah.
Yeah.
So, would this have been impeaching evidence if he had disclosed that information, or his failure to disclose that information in other depositions or interviews by law enforcement?
Well, the substance of the statement itself surely does not seem to have any impeachment value. As far as the fact that he failed to disclose it, I mean, I guess that has some impeachment value and certainly impeached him to that extent.
And he was cross-examined?
Yes.
Was he cross-examined out of the hearing of the jury, and then was he cross-examined when the jury was back also?
Yes.
And were similar questions asked both times?
Right. And it was brought up during
And the nature of his statement was that Clifton had told him that he murdered the victim?
The nature of the statement on the day after the murder, the one we're talking about here, the statement was to the effect of, don't worry, don't say anything, we got nothing to worry about. That was really the extent of the statement that the state elicited.
Don't worry, nothing to worry about because what?
Well, I suppose it was probably consistent with the prior statement that Rico Larry had provided, that immediately after the murder, when they're driving away, the defendant said, y'all got nothing to worry about. You don't have anything to worry about, I'm the one who did the end. So I suppose that latter statement is probably relating to that one and is conveying a similar message. But, I mean, as far as the latter statement, it is somewhat vague in and of itself.
So the only statement that that was made to police officers that wasn't disclosed was that Clifton told him, you don't have anything to worry about. That was it.
Based on my review of the record, as I recall, yes, Your Honor, that's the case.
Counsel, before you sit down, I apologize. I want to go back to the Batson issue. In the third step of a Batson challenge, the court has to weigh everything and determine if the defendant's established purposeful discrimination. What do you believe purposeful discrimination? Tell me what your thoughts are on that phrase.
Well, I mean, I guess you just need to show that the prosecution's reason for its strike is based on race. I don't know that you necessarily need to show that it had some sort of tactical benefit or some sort of tactical reason. I guess it's based on race. So then, what's your burden for?
Would it be similar to the prosecution intended to strike this juror because of some racial issue? Something along those lines?
Yeah. If the defendant met that burden, I think that would probably satisfy probably that test.
Yeah. Thank you.
Does race have to be the only cause for the strike? Isn't it sufficient if race is one of the causes for a strike?
I believe it would be, Your Honor.
Thank you.
If there are no further questions, we ask the judgment of the district. Thank you.
Thank you very much. Do we have time for rebuttal? There is no time for rebuttal. Our next case of the day is Cohoat versus Bennett Construction.